When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 18th of February, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing some of the construction news stories from the past couple of weeks. Some of the news stories we want to discuss anyway, Phil, not necessarily all the big ones, but we're not going to talk about poor Richard Howson and his big fine, are we? Because, you know, he's been through enough.
Well, this is, you mentioned Richard Howson, he's the Carillion chief executive who failed to be, or at least the board failed to be upfront and frank about the finances. And that goes back to 2017, 2018. Well, 2018 January was when Carillion collapsed. Howson's oversights were in the years before that. So that's, the news is that he's been fined 200 and something thousand pounds by the Financial Conduct Authority. But the actual offences date back getting on for a decade. So that's old news. Even older news, but still in the news, last week, the Restoration and Renewal Client Board of the Palace of Westminster came out with its latest report on proposals for a way forward for, and it's more than refurbishing, but refurbishing, for want of a better word, the Palace of Westminster, which in layman's terms means the Houses of Parliament. This has been going on for ages. And essentially, what this report said is that this decade or more of indecision of whether to crack on or not crack on means that the costs have just gone up and up and up. I don't know whether we've talked about this before in the 6 years we've been doing this podcast, David, but essentially there were three options, basically. Move everyone out of the building, get the builders in, do it up, everyone can move back in. Mm-hmm. That's called the full decant. There was a partial decant option where the Lord's side, which is the, if you're on the, sitting in the middle of the Thames, that's the right-hand end. So what's that, the east side of the complex? Hang on.
That's the other way around, surely.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. You're right. The Commons end. So the Lord's end is the west side of the palace. Yeah. Empty that out. They push off to, and they're talking about Queen Elizabeth Hall to be their home for several years. Do up the House of Lords end. Then they move back in. The Commons move out, and they're talking about them going to Richmond House, which used to be the, I think, Department of Health or the Department of Education.
Where is that? That's in central London as well, presumably.
It's a spitting distance from the House of Commons. Okay. Yes, it's one of the government buildings around there. And they'd move out. So that was called the partial decant option at one time. And then there was the stay where you are and the builders will work around you, which would take a lot longer, and that's called the, I can't remember what they call that, the, you know,
EMI plus. I can't remember what EMI
is. That's what they're now calling it. Yeah. Enhanced maintenance and improvement is what they're now calling it. But it used to be just the stay put option. They've now dropped the partial, the middle one. They now say, no, we're just going to give you a choice of two, make it easy, A or B. So we've got full decant or EMI, which is the builders working around them. Now, 10 years ago, the full decant option was costed at 3.5 billion. They're now saying it will cost up to 11.5 billion over between 19 and 24 years. So even if they're given a clean run at it, it could take anything from 19 to 24 years to do the work that needs to be done. If you spread it over that time, it's about £490 million a year on average, which doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah, but it's over nearly a quarter of a century.
Yeah. However, if they stay put and the builders work around them, Now, they were saying that would cost $5.7 billion 10 years ago. They're now saying that option would cost $18.7. So that's gone up more than three times, and three and a half times the cost of it in 10 years. And that would take 45 years to complete. 45 years if they don't move out of the way, if there is work around them. And, I mean, basically that means it will never finish in real terms.
Astonishing, isn't it?
So it's average annual cost $310 million if they work around them. And this has just been going on for, forever. They keep kicking into the long grass. And I heard, well, first of all, for a moment, should just say, this is not MPs, wanting faster Wi-Fi or, comfier chairs or something. This is a building of arguably international significance, one of the foundations of Western parliamentary democracy it represents. It's more the symbolism of the building than it's a huge national asset which has to be protected, and we cannot just let it crumble and die away. It is really, it's insanitary, it's unhygienic, it's a fire risk, asbestos, rats, mice, vermin. I mean, the pipe work, so everything behind that you can't see is...
I was going to say,
apart. Flooded basements and all that sort of stuff.
It's amazing, isn't it? Sounds like some massive slum. I mean, it's a wonder that the thing hasn't fallen into the Thames by now if it needs that amount of attention.
So the point is, something does have to be done. Yeah. Now, I listen to... I'm a regular listener of Ed Ball's George Osborne podcast, whatever that one's called. Political Currency, a voice has just whispered in my ear. Political Currency podcast. And they were talking about this, and they're making the point, the reason why MPs keep sort of deferring it and not saying we're going to do it is because, or at least we're not going to make a decision yet. They're not saying we're not going to do it. They're just saying, oh, let's have another inquiry. Let's have a new committee can look at this. And, we need to think more about this and have more reports on it. Two reasons, fundamentally. One, they like working. For all its faults, it's exciting being in Parliament.
You said it's an iconic building, isn't it? They don't.
Yes, and everything represents that you imagine you've just been elected to Parliament. Yeah, it says, but you're not allowed through the door. You've got to go to some modern office building around the corner for the next 10 years. And you're probably never going to, you'll be an MP for two terms and you might never step foot into the House of Parliament.
Yeah.
So that is why so many of them maybe subconsciously think, I'll just do my at least give me one term here and then we'll make a decision. And then you've got a new lot coming in. I understand that. My first job, I've probably told you before, David, my first job after university was working in the local pubs for a few months and that sort of thing. My first proper job was what these days they call a intern, but in those days a research assistant to a local MP, a Leeds MP in the House of Commons. So I spent a year, best part of a year, working in the House of Commons, and it really was a very exciting place to work, and you felt like the centre of everything, and all the news agendas happening around you, and it was great. Now that might happen to a lesser extent, but to some extent, wherever Parliament meets, gathers.
Sure.
But I get that, particularly a new MP would hate the idea of saying, no, you can't work in Parliament anymore, you need to move out because the builders are coming in. The second problem is that when we're talking about these billions and billions of pounds, they naturally are sensitive to the idea that the taxpaying public might think that, why are you spending money on your offices when hospitals are crumbling and we need hospitals more than we need you to have a comfy chair? And so there's that political... not dilemma, but aspect to it.
Yeah.
That they feel a little bit dirty saying, we're going to give ourselves, all these billions of pounds and we're going to take it away from things that the taxpayers, public services. So that is hard. So I've come to the conclusion that on that basis, The members of Parliament, the MPs in the House of Commons and the members of the House of Lords, peers, should not be given the responsibility for that decision, which is a tough one because ultimately they're the supreme, you might say the government's supreme body, but they're the supreme body of democracy. And if Parliament isn't allowed to make the decision of how, what happens to the building and how it's going, you know, where it's going to function, how it's going to be fixed or whatever, who can? And I don't have an answer to that. And they have increasingly, I mean, the reason why they set up this new client board was to try and make it a semi-detached thing with outside experts and, you know, representatives from the Commons and the Lords on this new client board to give it a sort of a, independence. But it's still not independent. And it's still going to be members of both houses at one point who are going to have to vote on whether we're going to go forward with this.
Yeah.
And so long as that happens, nothing's going to happen, is the way I see it. We'll be back here in 10 years' time having the same discussion until the thing, as you say, does just, whole edifice crumbles into the Thames, which would be a glorious metaphor. And we might be very close to that happening, but it would be a dreadful thing.
I mean, yeah, so, it's not as if there hasn't been any work done at the Palace of Westminster, because, I mean, there's been the Elizabeth Tower refurbishment and what's the... Oh, Elizabeth Tower is the one with Big Ben in it, isn't it?
Yes, and the other tower, is that Victoria Tower?
I think it might be. There's some work done there as well. McAlpine, yeah. I think, was the main contractor on the Elizabeth Tower. And they did, we had some lovely pictures from them.
But there's also, they're spending millions every year on what more than what you and I would call routine maintenance, emergency maintenance. You know, that's going on the whole time, but that's just a patch, it's just a sticking plaster job. But if you do take it away from them, the decision-making power for this,
Who's going to make the decision? The king, maybe.
Well,
English heritage.
that's not as mad an idea as you might think. I mean, of course, the king should have no jurisdiction over Parliament. I mean, go back to was it Charles I or Charles II who was dragged
1641.
Into the
house? I don't know.
Charles II was dragged in, wasn't he?
I can't remember.
I've got an A-level history and I can't remember. It's a long time ago. Both my A-level and 1641, about the same year, I think. But no, the idea of the king sort of telling Parliament what to do is impossible. What he could do, though, however, he has long made it known that he hates Buckingham Palace. And I don't think William has got much interest in Buckingham Palace. Now, if the king said, I am giving Buckingham Palace to the nation and I'm proposing that it could be the new Houses of Parliament and a new, new purpose, that it would be an equally grand, equally symbolic parliamentary building.
With a nice
Windsor
garden.
Castle. They've got Windsor Castle as the official residence of the monarch, which is a perfectly fantastic, not being there, but appears to be a perfectly fantastic palace. And the London residence, the Kensington Palace complex is surely fit for purpose, and all the other buildings that they've got around the place. So Buckingham Palace, why not make that the new Parliament?
That's a good idea.
The downside, of course, is that what you've got at the Palace of Westminster is you can step out of the tube station, Westminster Tube Station, and you've got a little tunnel, you can go straight into the palace. Getting from... Would it be Victoria Station?
Victoria, I think, is the nearest,
So, walking from Victoria to Buckingham Palace is not far, but there are sort of slightly more transport issues, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit further away from government offices. So, that might be an issue, but you set up a little Docklands-like railway, monorail or something.
Yeah, why not? No, that's a good idea. It hadn't occurred to me.
Well, my original idea 10 years ago when they're talking about this, and even then the idea was too late, is that County Hall would have made a good Parliament substitute. I mean, that I think that's off the table now.
It's an aquarium now, isn't it?
Do you know, have you been?
I've never been.
They're putting an aquarium in a cellar, but I've no idea if it's still there.
I don't know what's in there now.
But I rather like the symbolism of you'd have, government, i.e. Whitehall, on one side of the river, and facing it, Parliament on the other, across the river, and that have a nice sort of dynamic to it. But that, yeah, they say that's never going to happen. But the idea of the House of Parliament remaining the House of Parliament, I'll put that another way, the idea of the Palace of Westminster remaining the Houses of Parliament mm-hmm. in perpetuity, I don't think has got legs. And while it's a very, very famous building, it's not actually that old. I mean, it's only 18...
Some bits of it are.
60s or something, 1880s. Hang on, I'm going to just do a quick Google.
Palace. I can't remember who the architect was.
Pugin.
Was it Pugin?
Well, he might have done the...
He did some of it.
Interior stuff. Yeah, the existing building's built between 1840 and 1870. So,
but there's that medieval hall there, isn't there? Is it St George's Hall? What do they call it?
Westminster Hall.
Westminster Hall?
Westminster Hall is it? Yes. Well, the previous one burnt down basically. So
yeah.
you could say that it's founded upon an historic building that was there in the time.
But there's some medieval structure there, I'm sure.
There are remains of it. But you don't see that. When you look at the Palace of Westminster...
Oh, no, you don't see it.
That's a Victorian building, which is probably less old than your house, David. Charles Barry was the other architect.
Charles Barry, that's a chap.
Pugin did the interiors, the furnishing. Uh-huh. He was basically the decorator, and Barry was the... but it's a Gothic... the Gothic style of it, it's not... It's all a bit sort of fake, basically. In its day, it's a bit like a Disneyland kind of building.
Mm. Mind you, as time goes
pastiche.
By, Phil,
Victorian... Pastiche, is that the right word?
Yeah, pastiche. But, I mean, I think as time goes by, Victorian Gothic looks more and more heritage-y. Do you know what I mean? You know, people of our generation, born maybe just half a century or, well, a bit more than that, actually, after Victoria died, Victorian architecture doesn't seem all that old. But I think now, it's 120 years at least since the last Victorian building was erected. So it's getting there. But I do agree. I mean, there are some more venerable buildings in London. I mean, there's the Westminster Abbey just over the road, isn't there? Not suggesting that should be the Houses of Parliament, but... Yeah, it's an interesting point. You're saying that basically it doesn't have to be the Houses of Parliament in perpetuity. We could choose something else.
I think it's time. It's basically move out, move into Buckingham Palace, pull it down, or make it if you have an aquarium in the in County Hall, make it a ratarium.
It sounds like it's already won, but or just turn it into extremely. Expensive apartments and sell them off to Malaysians and Chinese and Russian oligarchs?
Well, that's often the solution that they seem to choose in London, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Well, I think whatever happens, you and I aren't going to see the completion of this project.
I don't think we'll see the start of it, David, I'm afraid to say, however long we live.
Shall we move on?
Yes, let's. We're going to talk about power tools next. You like a good power tool,
I do
you?
Like a good power tool, actually, yeah.
Well, I'm talking about power tools, David.
Well, we're talking about power tools because our most prominent manufacturer of construction equipment, JCB, its brand is obviously, it's got value. And so a bit like, do you remember when Caterpillar started selling footwear? And in fact, I think Caterpillar boots became more recognisable than Caterpillar excavators back in the 90s, at least. Everybody seemed to be wearing them. JCB has its badged apparel as well as machines, but also... Well,
I got my wife 3 pairs of JCB socks for Christmas.
Well, there we are then. There we are. And but they also have... Well, I was going to say that.
I should just add, I did give a couple of other things as well. That
good, okay. You better establish that, Phil, before you get into trouble. JCB power tools, though, that's what we're talking about. You can buy nice yellow JCB branded power tools, and you have been able to buy them for quite some time, actually. But like a lot of these things, it's the brand has currency and it can be licensed. And so it's not necessarily, when you buy a JCB cordless drill, it isn't actually made in Roaster by JCB itself. It's actually licensed to a licensee. And the one, the licensee we're talking about actually at the moment is based in Pembrokeshire in Wales. It's a company called Genpower. And you dug into this story, Phil, because there was a, we all got this press release about JCB Power Tools has rebranded a complete range of 18-volt power tools, and they're sort of really, you know, all singing, all dancing, high-quality, professional-grade power tools. And they're very proud of this. And I've always thought, because I, you know, knowing that the JCB brand has just been slapped on some Chinese-made tools for a long time, which is the sort of thing that happens a lot, that really these things are, it's all about the brand. You're paying for the name, a bit like a Rolex watch, I suppose. You're paying for the name, but the product itself isn't up to the things like what you'd expect to get from Bosch or Makita.
I think Rolex
or,
watches are okay, to be fair.
Yeah, they probably are. That's a bad analogy, actually. I'm just trying to think of a valuable brand. Yeah, okay. But yes, but basically a JCB cordless drill isn't going to perform as well or as long as, say, a Makita or a Bosch or a Milwaukee Power Tools, which are the ones which you tend to see being used day in, day out on building sites. But the news here is that no, JCB Power Tools really are competing with the best now, because this outfit, Genpower, they bought the Chinese licensee. I mean, I'd never heard of this outfit. Mind you, I'd never heard of Genpower before, but they were being branded, manufactured and marketed in the UK by Great Star UK, which was a Chinese-owned.
Well, there's some confusion about that. I initially said it was a Chinese-owned company. They said, oh, no, it wasn't a Chinese company.
Oh, wasn't it?
But I think ultimately, I think the ultimate ownership, well, I mean, Great Star certainly sounds like, and if you look at, you know, Great Star Company's house, ultimately there's an address in somewhere in China associated with it. So, but I think it was, they're trying to camouflage the Chinese-ness of the licensee.
Yeah.
But yes, they were made in China. But then most tools are made in China.
Yeah.
But there's made in China and made in China. There's made in China to Chinese standards and made in China, like, you know, my iPhone is made in China.
Well, exactly,
And, you know, when stuff can be made in China to international standards with international oversight, generally speaking, there's nothing wrong with it.
No,
you know, the concept of made in China is almost like two levels. We're talking about international standards or Chinese standards. And I think what Genpower, this new, yes, British family business, I think it's a family business, company have done, is they're saying, right, we've got the rights. Now we're going to up-spec it. We're up-specing the range. We're getting it made. And I don't know if it's made in the same factory, the tools are made in the same factory they were before, but to a different spec, or whether they've gone to someone who also makes, you know, whether it's for Makita or Milwaukee or one of these other people. But they've, the point is that it's the new JCB branded tools are, we are told, I haven't got my hands on, been interested to do a comparison between old JCB drill and a new JCB drill and see the difference. But the claim is that the new line, as you're saying, is absolutely properly up to par with the best on the market.
Well, they say they've spent the last 2 years in R&D, you know, sort of perfecting these things, and you know, 2 years sounds like a pretty rapid development program to me, actually, especially if you're talking about a whole suite of power tools, not just one. But they've been working on it, and now they've rebranded it. So I assume they don't say who actually makes them, where the components are made. I did find something when Googling it, saying while Genpower is a licensed distributor, they work with a global network of manufacturers employing a specialized quality control team to oversee production and conduct pre-delivery inspections. Now, I must confess immediately that's what AI told me. That's not, I didn't find an authoritative thing, but I mean, that's obviously probably comes from a Genpower website somewhere. But they go to specialist manufacturers. And as you say, they might very well be the same manufacturers that are producing Bosch, DeWalt, Milwaukee, Makita tools, because as you say, iPhones might be an American brand, but they're made in China, as are most. They're either made in China or they're made in North or South Korea, aren't they these days? So yeah, it might be exactly the same manufacturers, or it might be completely different ones.
What I find interesting in the world, and maybe have some insight into the world of power tools, that okay, Bosch is a brand which applies across a lot of power electrical products and has broad use, but it's a brand. But a lot of these big power tool companies like DeWalt, Makita, and Milwaukee, they're not. That's just what they do. As far as I know, that's just what they do. Mm. Whereas other kind of machinery, I don't know. Why aren't there Kawasaki power drills or Sony power drills?
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, these sort of Eastern European manufacturers, I mean, the Japanese, of course, were the first. And also the South Korean Kaibols, or whatever they call them, these big conglomerates. They made everything, didn't they? I mean, think of Yamaha. Yamaha makes motorcycles. It also makes the world's best trombones and pianos, you know, Mitsubishi and companies like that. Yeah, presumably they just decide, well, I will, I can see a gap in the market, I'll fill it. I don't know. I mean, when cameras went digital, it stopped being Canon and Nikon and it became Sony and Panasonic and things like that. And, you know, when technology evolves.
Did it? Oh, I'll challenge that. I think it's still Nikon and Canon.
Well, yeah, all right, then they're still there. They're the big names. But, I mean, Sony and Panasonic saw a way into that market because of the electronics, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I imagine maybe the power tool market is already fairly crowded, and the big Kawasaki, the motorcycle manufacturers, and Kubota, the mini excavator manufacturers, don't see any benefit in diversifying into that sector.
See, Harley-Davidson is a brand that should put itself about into things like this. I mean, can you imagine marching onto site with a Harley-Davidson breaker or something? Oh, yeah, I've got a Harley. Got a hog.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't be able to lift it, though. That's a trouble. No, it is interesting, actually, because, I mean, when you think about power tools, there are only, I don't know, half a dozen big names that jump out at you. I mean, there are the specialist ones, people like Hilti. There's a manufacturer of woodworking tools, which really is like the sort of Patek Philippe of power tools. But they make is woodworking tools. And I can't remember what the name is. But I mean, German engineering, obviously being absolutely world famous for its quality and robustness. You can buy Fein, F-E-I-N, power tools. They're really good, high quality professional tools, but you won't find them in your local builder's merchant. You won't find them in B&Q or anywhere like that. They are, you know, they're for people who are going to use these things 8 hours a day.
What's your take on middle of Lidl power tools?
Oh, I have invested heavily in middle. I once went, not just power tools. Have I actually bought a power tool? Yeah, I bought something. I can't remember what it was. But I did once go into my local Lidl looking for croissants, because they do make the best croissants. They're far better than Sainsbury's or Tesco's.
So you went in for croissants and came out with a power tool?
I came out with a fly fishing kit. a rod, line, flies. The flies were crap. But I saw it was there for less than 30 quid, and I thought, and I've got an old cane rod that I inherited from my dad, and it really isn't very good. And I thought, why not? At $29.99, you can't go wrong. And in actual fact, I've never blanked with it. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of the middle of Lidl. You can get some great bargains there.
My best buy in the middle of Lidl ever was a set of bagpipes, which I bought for a friend for Christmas.
You are joking.
I knew he was going up to Edinburgh for Hogmanay. So I thought, this is a good Christmas present. You can take those with you. You got 4 days to learn how to play them.
Seriously, bagpipes?
It was a slightly kiddie set, but they were real bagpipes. You could get a tune out of them. Well, I couldn't, obviously, but the tune, you know, they were playable.
That's astonishing.
They were slightly smaller. That was the most extraordinary. I mean, how can you walk away from that? You see bagpipes in your supermarket, you just got to buy them. And they're only, I don't know what I paid, 15 quid or something.
Incredible.
If that.
Yeah. I do remember when I first became aware of the middle of Lidl, I walked down there and I found next to the angle grinders an electronic drum kit. And I just thought that was a strange, a strange sort of comparison.
You didn't buy it?
No, I didn't buy it. I can't play the drums. But
electronic, you don't need to. You play the violin, Dave.
You still have to hit them, Phil.
No, you just key in 17359 and it'll play you something and violin
well,
along
maybe,
to it.
Maybe I missed a trick there. But
I've never used an electronic drum kit. I'm only guessing that's what you do.
I think, now we've got onto the middle of Lidl. They do have an enormous array of power tools and other tools.
They do.
And they all purport to be made in Germany. I tried to find out where my fly fishing kit was made, and I couldn't get further than Germany. And I thought it must be Chinese.
I think they're made in Germany to the extent that a German person puts a sticker on it when it gets to Germany.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But I don't know.
Oh, might be sued by Lidl now. That's our mouth.
Anyway, JCB's the brand to go for now, apparently, because they're top quality products. And, they've got the JCB logo on. Can't go wrong.
Well, let's see. If you have any experience of JCB power tools.
Oh, yeah, do let us know.
At theconstructionindex.co.uk. Yeah. We would love to know. Or you could Instagram David.
No, you can't. I don't do Instagram. That won't work. That won't work.
Let's talk about a house builder who is not normally associated with... it's normally associated with less good news, let's say. Less bad bad publicity rather than good publicity. Mm-hmm. But Persimmon Homes has put out a couple of press releases lately of interesting things to do with its recycling initiatives. Mm. And none of it's groundbreaking, but it's just... I think it's interesting to see, maybe everyone's doing it to a greater or lesser extent. But the first one, last month, we reported that they'd teamed up with a software provider, an app, whatever, something called the Nexus Regen Materials Exchange platform. All the Persimmon regional businesses have all signed up to this. And the idea is that they list all their materials, heavy materials, soil aggregate, heavy materials requirements for each site on the platform. So all the other bits of all the other Persimmon sites can go, they need 82 bags of cement over there. We've got 10 free. We'll send that over there. And it's to move surplus material, within the company rather than everyone buying too much and
wasting
what they don't use. So that was quite interesting, I thought. One Persimmon project achieved a 43% cost saving by reusing surplus topsoil locally. So that's, I don't know what 43% cost saving on topsoil amounts to, but it's good.
Well, that's a big saving. It's a big saving anyway, isn't it? Yeah.
And then a few weeks later, this was a couple of weeks ago, last week we talked about, we ran a piece how they've teamed up with another third-party company called Ecofill, a Leeds-based company that specialises in aggregate replacement products. Hmm. And they did a few trials with Ecofill's technology on some of their house-building sites and found, we like it, we're rolling it out, we're going to use it. Now, you're better on this sort of thing. Explain what Ecofill does, Dave, and how Persimmon is using it, please.
Well, I am familiar with the concept because I wrote about this 13 years ago. It's
how long ago?
13 years ago, I checked. It's 2013 when I wrote a feature for the magazine about this. One of the first ones I wrote for it. A lot of people might be familiar with the concept of soil stabilization, in situ stabilization using lime or cement, and in fact there are. Is it Wirtgen? They make a specialist machine that goes along and it mixes.
I've heard of that.
It mixes up. Basically, you've got a site. You strip off the topsoil, and all you've got is this cohesive clay subsoil there, and you want to build on it. And of course, you don't want any heave or subsidence or anything like that. So you either dig it all out and fill it with expensive quarried aggregate, or you get one of these Vertgen machines and it trundles up and down, and it's like a rotavator. It disturbs the top surface of the soil, I don't know, down to about half a metre, I don't know, and mixes it with either lime or cement. And that modifies the sort of cohesive soil, the clay-rich soil.
It's like corn flour in your baking, isn't it? You stick a bit of corn flour in to thicken your sauce.
To thicken it, yeah, basically. Yes, it's a bit like my pastry, I guess. So you end up with this sort of, it goes off, you compact it, and it acts like a granular fill, so like type 1 MOD aggregate. And so it's a good way of modifying the soil, because it means you don't have to dig it out, dump it, and then bring in quarried material. You just use what's on site. So it's cost efficient. It's very green, of course. And it's a very well-established technique. It's used all over the place. So a lot of people will be familiar with that. Well, the ecofill concept is basically, as far as I can tell, the same thing. But you don't do it in situ. You excavate the material. You put it into a machine. Looks a bit like a crushing or screening plant. You put it in, you tip it into this machine, and the machine does all the magic. So it heats it, it mixes it, chops it up, mixes in the additives, whether that's lime cement or something else. And then out of a conveyor at the other end comes this stuff, which you can just tip back into your trenches or into your excavations as fill. And so basically, Persimmon, what they're doing is they're obviously building houses on this site. They're digging out the soil and they're processing it using the ecofill machine and then taking it back onto site. Well, actually, it probably hasn't left the site. That's the idea. You do it in situ and then just putting it back into the ground to create a solid foundation for your houses. Well, as I said, I have written about this 13 years ago, when there was a demolition company, which I believe is still going. It's called Keynes. It's based in Kilburn in North London. David Keane, actually, the managing director of the company, was the chief executive or chairman of the National Federation of Demolition Contractors. It's a demolition firm, highly respected, although quite a small business. Well, they developed a product which they called Trench Mod. They designed and had built a machine called the Keynes Mixer, which actually does, as far as I can tell, exactly what the ecofill machine does. You dig out the clay soils, you tip it into the machine, and out comes your type 1 aggregate. And they were very successful with this, actually. I had a look back at what I wrote back in 2013, and in 2008, the Trench Mod was already recognized and approved by Thames Water, and they were consuming up to 1,500 tons a week of this stuff for their utilities work, backfilling trenches, basically. And I think who else? Can't remember. Some other organization followed suit. I mean, they were, let me see, I've got a few figures here. Company called Brown Construction was their streetworks contractor. They processed more than 60,000 tons of soil at an estimated cost saving of £20 per ton, a total cost saving of roughly 1.2 million. This was back in 2008. So the idea has been around for a while. David Keane, actually, when I spoke to him back then, was a little bit irritable, actually, because a lot of people, he'd gone around speaking to contractors and clients and people who he thought ought to be interested. Thames Water was, but a lot of them said, nice idea, but no, we'll just carry on doing it our way. But then they went off and very quietly started to replicate what he was doing. And he had international patents on the product, on the machine, on various aspects of it, all the key aspects of the system. And he said, these people are violating my patents. They might not even know they're doing it, but they just, people were saying, this is a good idea, we'll run with it, but they weren't using Keane's idea. So he was very frustrated because it was a great idea and it was acknowledged to be a great idea, but he couldn't really get sort of national approval or national adoption of it. And I don't, I Googled trench mod, nothing comes up now, except my article. It's really sad.
Interesting. Well, when I wrote the persimmon story, I had no idea about trench mod. I didn't know the background of it, and I perhaps should have looked into it at the time. But
well, it seems
you fleshed it out.
Yeah, well, it does, it's only because I spoke at length to David Keane and wrote quite a lot about it at the time. That obviously I was familiar with it and it struck a chord. But I think a lot of people in the industry, if they did know about it, I don't know. It just didn't have any sort of
momentum.
It didn't seem to have any momentum, and it seemed to sort of wither and die. And if David Keane is listening to this and wants to put me right, I'd be delighted to hear from him again. It's been years since I've spoken to him, but I'd love to know what happened to trench mod and if it's still going and how the market has reacted over the years.
Well, David, you haven't got David's email address. It's podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. We'll get through to it very quickly.
Yeah.
Anything else on the agenda, David?
Well, there was a nice little story that you did, actually, which caught my attention, which was another rebranding job. We've talked about rebranding in the past, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think this one is one that doesn't work particularly well. It was the Brickability, I think, was the name of the company. It was a brick merchant. Was it Brickability?
Brickability, yes.
It isn't Brickability now. Brickability is quite a good name, I think. Trips off the tongue and it sort of does what it says on the tin. But they've rebranded as what, Phil?
As I said in the piece that I posted, they've gone all Aberdoon on us.
Yeah.
They've changed their name from Brickability to, I'm going to spell it and you can tell me how to pronounce it, to BRCK. Is that brick or burk?
Burk. Sounds a bit like a fart.
It's a burk.
Yeah.
I mean, my first reaction was the Daft Buggers, because Aberdeen, the, what are they? They're
an investment firm.
Investment firm. Yeah. I knew their money, but investment house, Aberdeen. They changed their name in asset management firm, as you call it.
Yeah. That's it, yeah.
They changed it. In 2021, they rebranded as... They basically took out all the E's and became... Everyone took the piss. And after 4 years of mocking, they thought, OK, we're stupid. People aren't going to call us... So they changed their name back to Aberdeen, which is a perfectly good name. One thing in Burke's defence, and we call them Burke, in Burke's defence, BRCK is at least their ticker. They're AIM-listed. They're listed on the alternative investment market of the London Stock Exchange. And their stock market ticker, the little symbol which you often get, so the short abbreviation for them, is BRCK anyway.
Oh, that's so interesting.
If you're in the money markets and you're looking for BRCK, you go, oh, BRCK, I know that company. It's BRCK. It's short for Brickability. Well, no, it's not. It's just Burke.
There's some logic in that then. I can see what they're doing. But then they're only really addressing the financial markets, aren't they? Not the house builders.
I think, again, in their defence, because it's very easy and almost obligatory to take the piss. And again, their defence. I think what they're doing is that as the company's growing, Brickability is their original brick merchant bit, and they've got other bits that do. I think other materials that they deal in. I think, and they're looking to build that up. And so I think the idea is that Brickability will remain as a brand, as a brick merchant, and there'll be other companies within, and they're all part of the Burke,
under the Burke
group.
Burke umbrella. Yeah. It sounds a bit more logical, a bit more understandable now you've explained that. But
it's still a rubbish name to pick.
I still think it's very risky, especially after the ridicule which was heaped on Aberdeen. In fact, looking at this yesterday, I felt quite sorry for Aberdeen because somebody, one of their senior directors, actually said that all this mockery amounted to corporate bullying. And they sounded like they really were hurt by it, and I felt quite sorry for them. But I mean, there were some. Yeah, I mean, you should Google it. There's some wonderful comments on social media about it. But it was it, backfired spectacularly. Don't know whether Burke will go the same way or not. At least they seem to have more justification for taking out the vowels from their name. And there was only one vowel, of course, to take out.
Well, we've said before that Mace are rebranding their contracting business because the American bank who bought consulting business and seem to have got the Mace name. So maybe they're going to change their name to MC and just be Muck. Let's hope not. Don't do it, Mace. Whatever you do,
no,
don't do it.
No, definitely not. Yeah, it's a minefield out there. You've got to be very careful with your branding.
But vowels are good and they're useful.
Yeah, I think so.
Keep vowels, folks.
Okay.
Right, okay. Well, I think we're done, Dave, for another fortnight. But same time next time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We've had fun. I hope you have too. And we'll be back. So from David and I, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.